Well, hi everybody. Welcome to the Taib Chum Bucket Podcast. I'm Robin Smith. I'll be hosting and I'm here with Justin Ritchie. Together we work at the Taib. We're sort of regular contributors.
I contribute occasionally on issues of economics and how it impacts here in British Columbia, kind of the global economic picture.
Mm-hmm. What we're trying to do with the podcast is do some original stories, bring in more of you guys, more readers, recap sort of the hottest debates on the Taib. We'll interview some of our reporters. We'll put some of our reporters together to fight it out over whatever you guys want to hear. And we'll do lots of dispatches from in and around BC. So we're promising you a lot. And as time goes on, the podcast will continue to grow and develop and become a real chum bucket.
What is a chum bucket, Robin?
Well, a chum bucket is nautical slang for a bucket filled with fishing bait at sea, plural. Chum buckets. This is a name that a lot of people at the Taib wanted the podcast to be named. I don't know if you've noticed, but we're really into fish analogies and fish metaphors. And do you have another idea for the podcast?
I don't know. I'd love to hear what our listeners think about the name and about potential names for the podcast. But, you know, I think for now, we'll go with chum bucket.
What do you have against chum bucket?
I don't know. Doesn't it sound gross? Don't you think it sounds gross?
No, it's a very acceptable tool for fishermen.
Okay. Well, hopefully what can happen is you, the Taib readers and now podcast listeners, will be able to take the stories that are in the Taib and interesting stories here in BC and use that as bait to contribute to this podcast.
Nice.
So
nice.
It all links together with the chum bucket concept.
Mm-hmm. Today, just to start off on the podcast, we'll talk to UBC J School prof Candace Callison about her recent post on J Source, which is a Canadian journalism website, about climate change coverage in new media and her thoughts on climate change coverage. Very topical.
And after that, we're going to hear an interview I recorded at the Association for the Advancement of Science conference that was here in Vancouver this past weekend. It was a very interesting conference. I recorded an interview about archaeoacoustics, which is a new field of science, and there's some interesting theories about Stonehenge that emerged from it.
Ooh, Stonehenge. New theories of science. And we'll talk to a Taib reporter about melting glaciers and what they're going to do for our province. So we have Stonehenge, glaciers. Already this chum bucket is filling up fast.
Such a gross name.
Chum bucket. That's it.
Yeah. So with all that, I think we should just jump into the interview with Candace.
Yeah, let's give her a call. You talk about new research that shows a steady decline in climate change coverage. I think you said in major newspapers it peaked in 2007, but yet more and more people believe that climate change is a direct threat. So the question that you ask is whether it's the internet that's keeping climate change on the radar by presenting new platforms for debate, or is it something else?
I pulled that research from this column that was in the Toronto Star. The columnist had been trying to talk to me about it, but I wasn't available at the time. But I found it really interesting that she was asking that question. Is it the internet that's keeping the issue alive? And the experts she talked to in social science were saying the conversation has not slowed down online. In fact, it's only ballooned and we're still trying to get our head around it. And so that's sort of where my column comes in at that point, where how do we begin to think about new media as this very different set of sources, but also a really different set of circulation, and with social networks playing a major role, how do we begin to think about news within that? And of course, that's something we talk and think about all the time at the journalism school at UBC. And my research has looked a lot at alternative ways of climate change being taken up by the public. And so that's where sort of my ideas about new media forcing journalists and news organizations to rethink of themselves as sort of chief discussant and performing roles related to verification is really different than this idea that we've got the story, we're going to set the agenda. And so somewhere in between there, right, in between this kind of original ideas of me as agenda center and watchdog and media as a forum to discuss and debate is where journalism is trying to continue to reinvent itself in that space.
Is it the form that new media provides that gives it the advantage that it has in covering climate change? Or if not, what is the advantage that new media has in covering climate change?
Well, I don't know if it's necessarily something I would characterize as advantage. I think what it does is allow for different kinds of uptake, different kinds of translation, and it allows for debate. And so people passing things around and reinforcing kinds of views, you get paradoxically, right, with the exposure to more sources and more different kinds of information, people are able to access other points of view, right? You would think that there's more reinforcement, but in fact, there's, you know, research is showing us that people are exposed to more diverse points of view.
Why is it that even the mainstream news media isn't going after that? Why? What's the speculation behind that?
Why isn't mainstream media covering science issues?
Yeah.
Well, it's mainly money, right? It's the restructuring of the industry, and what do we have money and personnel to cover? Well, just the nuts and bolts, right? And science is seen as extraneous for many news organizations, I think, is part of it. But I mean, the other thing I often think about is that science has been shoved over in this really specialty, special knowledge category. And if you think about most of the central policy issues facing Western democracies, they are science and technology related issues, right? And so the argument has been, well, we'll just fold those into whatever other stories we're doing. And I think that there's really legitimate debate about whether or not reporters need some specialist knowledge to cover these issues and whether or not you can just cover them as part of generalist science.
Do you think that coverage on climate change and climate science is convincing anybody? Or do you think that most people are coming to the table having a particular mindset on the issue?
I think that people come to be engaged and care about issues through a variety of means. I think information is one of those means. And so for some people, that's the primary way. And for other people, it's a much more varied process. And for other people, it's, you know, through the social groups that they are part of. And so that's been a lot of, the latter has been a lot of what my research has focused on, is how groups that are not part of the science and environment movement have taken up climate change and sort of said, hey, we as a group need to care about this, and here's how we want to see it addressed from our point of view. And I think that that, you know, opens up notions of who can speak for and about climate change and who are the best messengers to take climate change to parts of the very diverse publics that are out there.
That's interesting. With that sort of proliferation, though, of new media, with all of these new players taking up climate change, as you said, I think there's a concern that all of those voices sort of muddy the waters in terms of what is fact and what is fiction in climate change. What do you think of that?
Well, it's really interesting. There was a noted climate scientist at the AAAS who is one of the first people I've heard that, you know, truly echoes some of what my own research has found, and that is that people take science and they invest it with meaning and make it part of their own narrative and make it ethical and moral. And I'm not sure that fact and fiction is such a strong distinction, right? I think understanding basic scientific evidence and understanding science as a process as opposed to a textbook is really an important message that needs to be a part and parcel of how we think about climate change. And then we can kind of move away from the uncertainty arguments.
Well, that was a great conversation with Candace Callison.
Yeah, absolutely. We really got a great perspective on new media and the role that it plays in climate change journalism.
I feel like we really have to take up the mantle now at the TAI.
Absolutely.
Tea, Justin?
Sure, thank you. Perfect.
Oh, my phone's ringing. Who's calling me in the middle of... Oh, it's our web editor, Jeff. I'm going to switch over to my phone.
Chumbucket. Like, seriously? So have you ever smelled a chumbucket?
No, have you?
Yes. It is the most disgusting foul. Well, I mean, it can be the most disgusting foul thing ever. Have you ever seen what's in a chum bucket? They're all different, right? But like we're talking like a slurry of rancid chicken, cat food, fish guts. It's disgusting, horrible stuff.
I think you're purposefully going towards the extreme right now. I mean, there's probably...
Like a nicer, friendlier chum bucket?
Yeah. I mean, I think you're overreacting. I think the chum bucket represents exactly what we want. It chum friendly, you know, bait bucket full of promise for.
Sorry, I listened to your pilot, and you guys you guys are doing great work. You know, I don't want your work to be represented by something that isn't that appealing. I mean, it might be appealing to fish, but I don't know if it's appealing to humans. In fact, like when I think of a chum bucket, it's really not appealing.
Okay.
Don't let me stop you. I'm just saying, like, I don't know, you might want to reconsider the name.
Jeff, what if I said to you that maybe you're being a bit of a, not a prude, what's the word I'm looking for?
Rational?
Maybe you're overthinking it.
Or maybe I'm just reacting viscerally.
Okay.
Maybe that's what we're going for. A visceral reaction.
Let's change the frame a little bit. Let's say there's this great website. It's in the middle of the Midwest where there are a lot of cows, and they have a really great cow. They call it called maybe it's the Jersey cow, and it's called the Jersey website, and they do great reporting. And they come up with a podcast, and they call the podcast the manure.
I thought you were going to say the Jersey Shore, but
oh, nice. Okay. Anyway, I mean, yeah, whatever. Like, wouldn't be my first choice, all I'm saying.
Okay, well, do you think we could put it to our readers maybe and let them decide?
I think absolutely do that. I totally trust our readers or listeners.
I just think we're too deep in it to make a rational decision right now.
We're too deep inside the chum bucket is what we're saying.
Oh, no, I think sorry. Yeah. Yes. Readers, please help us. Please help us.
You know, Jeff complains a lot. I'm just putting it out there.
What else has he complained about at the Tai?
Well, he didn't come with any ideas. He just complained.
So you're saying that he didn't suggest any alternative names for the podcast?
Mm-hmm. That's not constructive.
Okay. Well, let's hope our listeners can do better.
Yeah.
That.
And let's just move on. I'm ready to move on. Okay. So you were at the American Association for the Advancement of Science conference in Vancouver last week?
Yeah, last weekend. And it was really a blast, and a blast of sound from the past.
Whoa.
Archaeoacoustics. It's not every day that you get to be at the first initial session that an entire scientific field has. And so this session was three different researchers, one of them soon to be a recipient of a PhD from Stanford, on her research on a particular monument in Peru and the particular resonances that this ancient monument had. And so what would happen is there is this special shell horn called the Petulu. And the Petulu has this exact frequency that it makes its sound at. And all the chambers have been specially designed so that you can sit inside the monument and you don't know where the actual sound is coming from this Petulu instrument. And there were carvings on the wall of how everyone would play the horn, and then they would eat what was called the San Pedro cactus. And then because they couldn't place where the sound was coming from, it caused very interesting psychoactive effects.
That sounds pretty niche.
Yeah, it was pretty niche. And then there were other presenters about other ancient monuments and the way that sound was incorporated into the construction of them.
And so you met one of these scientists and talked to him pretty in depth about his research.
Absolutely. Dr. Stephen Waller has a background in biochemistry, and he just suddenly became fascinated with the ways that the ancient mind perceived sound. And so that led him on a quest around the world to hundreds of different monuments where he started looking at the impact that sound had on their creation of them, and also on the art, the petroglyphs, the cave art, and he had some very interesting discoveries to present.
Well, my background is I'm a PhD in biophysics, biochemistry, and I did do some work on the effect of sound on DNA, but that was like way back. So what I'm doing now with archaeoacoustics, which is the study of sound in the ancient past, is an avocation of mine. It's not really related to my day job, but I still try to apply scientific analysis and techniques to what I'm doing. So it's a study of sound. And I started out by studying the sounds in prehistoric caves where our ancestors risked their lives to go deep down in the cave and only draw certain animal species in certain chambers of the cave. So at one of these French caves in the southern Pyrenees, I was standing at the mouth of the cave and thinking, if I were a caveman, why would I go deep in there and risk my life and draw these paintings and all? And I happened to hear an echo come out of the cave. And maybe it was because I was trying to think like a caveman. When I heard that echo, I actually perceived it as a spirit answering back, because I think my subconscious remembered learning about the myths that Echo was a spirit who called back, and the echo was her answer, because the ancient people didn't know about sound waves propagating and reflecting off of boundary layers. Their explanation was that there was a spirit in the rock. Very similar to when you look in a mirror, you look in the mirror and you see depth, you see an image in the mirror as if it was a window to the other world. Well, the same thing happens with sound. It gives that illusion of depth and that there's a virtual sound source in there. And what we would call a virtual sound source, they just consider to be a non-corporeal sound source, i.e. a spirit. Mm-hmm. So it all, you know, fits in. And then it turns out that if you clap in these chambers that were decorated, you hear this thunderous reverberation. And what they were drawing, it turns out, is 90% of the species that they depict are hoofed animals. Mm-hmm. And they show these stampedes of hoofed animals in these reverberating galleries. It sounds like thunderous reverberation. And I realized that maybe they were trying to depict the same supernatural animals in the caves as what they thought was causing the thunder in the sky.
That maybe they were painting on the walls what they thought they were hearing,
yes,
in a way.
Yeah, and what they thought they were hearing apparently were hoofed animals. Just like when they hear the thunder in the sky during a thunderstorm, they pictured that as being caused by the thunder gods who were galloping across the sky on their horses and in their goat-drawn chariots. Mm-hmm. You know, that's how they perceived it. And there are paintings that show these stampedes of hoofed animals galloping across the clouds as how they pictured the thunderstorms. And when you match those paintings up with the prehistoric paintings, they're very, very similar in that they're depicting these stampedes of hoofed animals, you know, with their thunderous galloping. So anyway, so that's what I've been doing, is going to all these rock art sites around the world that are in caves and canyons and on cliff faces, and measuring the sound reflection levels and showing that quantitatively the places with the best echoes are the places that the artist chose to put their paintings. And in some cases, you can actually stand back and yell, and the paintings will speak back to you. What I found is that characteristically, those are the places where you can hear a good echo. Mm-hmm. Well, we would call it an echo today and think of it as the sound waves bouncing off the cliff, but they thought of it as the answer of the echo spirit in the cliff. So if you stand back and you yell, a voice will come out of the solid rock.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know? So one last question. What do you think it would have been like to be one of the first people to wander into these caves in Lascaux, for example, in France, and then suddenly hear this echo reverberating out?
It would have been this incredible, magical, spiritual experience. And you would want to go and tell your people and bring them and have them experience it. And it would definitely form your whole worldview of like what's happening. Because if you clap in the middle of a field, you just hear yourself clap. If you clap in one of these magic places, you hear thunder.
It would almost be like the earth itself was speaking to you in a way.
Right, yeah. I mean, it was just a communication kind of thing. So that's how I actually got into studying Stonehenge, which is thousands of years later. The prehistoric paintings are between like 10,000 years old, and now they think some are as old as 40 to 100,000 years old, whereas Stonehenge is relatively modern at only 5,000 years old. But it was still like in the ancient past where ancestors didn't realize about sound. So when I looked at the pattern of Stonehenge and how it was laid out, it just reminded me of an interference pattern. And I realized that today we know that the sound waves cancel each other out and you get dead spots. But back then, they would have thought that that was like magic. You know, why? You'd think if you had two pipers, it'd be louder than one. So why, if you have two pipers and you stand in these certain spots, is it almost completely silent? So when I set that up for myself, two flutes in the middle of a field, and I experienced those dead zones, it was like there was some object blocking the sound, something between me and the flutes that felt, you could feel it, that there was something blocking the sound, even though intellectually I knew that it was just the sound waves canceling each other out. That's not something you experience every day. It's a much more common experience to like walk behind some large object, like a tree or something, and hear it blocking the sound. But that's what it feels like. You can sense that there's something blocking the sound when there really isn't. And so as you walk around in a circle around a pair of pipers, they could have experienced the sound wave interference pattern, which kind of radiates out like spokes of a wheel. And so you alternately experience loud and silent, loud and silent, loud and silent. And these silent zones are like you're passing by these objects blocking the sound. So the net result is you get this vision of a circle of massive invisible objects. It's like this vision from the other world, you know? And it must be magic because you can't see it.
Because you've never experienced anything like this before, if you're coming from that worldview.
The only explanation would be there's some invisible object. They would have, in technical terms, they would have been using an impedance model of something blocking the sound. And so with that being their only possible model and this vision in their mind of this ring of magic objects, I think that served as the design for Stonehenge and these other stone circles, and that's why they were building it as a temple. It's like, we experienced this vision. It was like, you know, a vision from the other world. So when you see Stonehenge or this other circle, it's like that's their representation of the vision that they received. And so I did acoustic studies at Stonehenge to show, you know, what the acoustic shadows are like. Because if they were envisioning the interference pattern being caused by this structure blocking the sound, then when they actually built that structure, what it actually does now is recreates that interference pattern. It recreates that auditory illusion. And so I put a sound source in the middle of Stonehenge and then walked around the portion that's still, you know, upright. And as you pass by a stone, it blocks the sound. And so it's like, you know, much quieter there. And then when you walk further in the circle and you pass by the gaps between the stone, the sound gets through clearly, so it's loud. And then you pass by another stone and it's quiet. Keep going, loud, quiet, loud, quiet. It's the exact same experience you get in an interference pattern.
And I'm sure that anyone who's listening could look up an interference pattern and see how the sound emanates out through particular pathways and then see where there would be blocks.
Yeah, if you look down, it almost looks like a the spokes of a wheel. It's kind of radiating. So It's like Stonehenge actually radiates these acoustic shadows that recreates this experience of loud and quiet and loud and quiet, because that's what they envisioned, the structure that was causing the interference pattern in the first place. And so I think it's unlikely that that's just a coincidence, that first of all, you can have an auditory illusion of Stonehenge from an interference pattern, and that Stonehenge itself then casts acoustic shadows that mimic an interference pattern. That, I think, is enough to say it's not coincidence. But furthermore, the icing on the cake are the legends associated with these stone rings. A lot of the megalithic stones are actually called Piper's Stones. So many of them, there's like a dozen, and that's the name of it, that it's like a generic term. That's how they thought of these stones, that they were Piper's Stones. And there's even a legend that two magic pipers enticed these maidens to dance around in a circle in a field, and they all turned to stone. So that's all you need to set up an interference pattern, is two pipers. And to experience it, all you have to do is walk or dance around in a circle, and you experience this interference, these dead zones, and you have this feeling that there's some object.
Do you think that two people were playing a flute or something in a field, and then people were dancing around, and suddenly they were experiencing this, and they were thinking, wow, you know, we should build a monument to this effect?
Yes, yeah, that's because it was a magic effect. It's like how they couldn't explain it other than it being supernatural.
Right.
It was a sign.
Fascinating. Well, thanks so much for your time today,
Dr.
Stephen Waller. And I look forward to speaking to you more in the future.
Okay, thank you.
All right. Well, Robin, I know it's going to be hard to top maidens turning into stone due to magic pipers, but I think we might be able to do it with a little help from a glacier.
Ah, good point. So one of the big stories on the Tai'i this month was Colleen Kimmett's story about Bridge Glacier, this glacier in northern British Columbia that produces a huge amount of hydroelectric power for BC, and she got the chance to fly up and hang out at the glacier with a bunch of scientists.
I'm looking forward to speaking with Colleen.
Let's give her a call.
Well, my story was about melting glaciers in British Columbia. I visited one glacier in particular, Bridge Glacier, in the Coast Mountains, and it's melting at an astonishing rate, 200 meters per year. And scientists are trying to figure out how quickly glaciers will melt over the next 50 years or so, and what it will mean for stream flow. So the runoff, basically, that comes down the mountain as all of this ice melts. And in particular, I looked at how this decline in stream flow will impact hydroelectric generation.
So you flew up there for this story. How did that happen? Did you just hop on a flight and say, take me to Bridge Glacier, and the pilot knew exactly where that was? Or?
Well, I flew with three scientists, so two professors from the University of British Columbia and one of their graduate students, and members of their team have been making regular trips to Bridge Glacier, and we took a float plane that actually left from Tyak's Lodge north of Pemberton, and I received a travel grant from the Society of Environmental Journalists to help pay for part of the float plane trip, because it's quite expensive. It's close to $1,000 each way. I was really excited about flying in a float plane because I never had, and I actually ended up being quite airsick on the way out there, so it turned out to be the first time I used a barf bag also, which was embarrassing because I'd had to convince the UBC prof who led the trip, Dan Moore, that I was tough and rugged enough to go on this type of expedition. Everyone was cool about it, though, and quite sympathetic, because apparently it's not unusual to feel this way on a float plane.
In the story, we don't hear too much about your day with the glacier. What was that like, hanging out on this ice floe?
We actually weren't on the glacier itself. We were hanging out just in front of the glacier in a kind of valley that formed when the glacier retreated about 12,000 years ago. And in the middle of this valley was Bridge Lake, where we landed the float plane, where the pilot landed the float plane. And this is a lake that's been forming below Bridge Glacier as it melts. And on either side of this lake were steep slopes. And this geological feature is actually called a moraine, a glacial moraine. So if you can imagine kind of digging your heel into a gravel pile and scraping it back, and the gravel will create a ridge on either side of where your foot was, that's kind of what the glacier did here. And it was interesting because a colleague of Dan Moore's from UBC, Michelle, who was there, pointed out that basically most of North America was once covered in ice, and so everything we see has been shaped by ice to some extent. I thought that was pretty interesting.
Bridge Glacier is responsible for about 6 to 8% of the province's electrical supply, and so BC Hydro, of course, is going to be monitoring this very closely. You weren't able to speak with anyone from BC Hydro for this piece, but if you had, what would you want to ask them?
I was curious to know just how much they know about Bridge Glacier specifically, and if they've done any modeling or commissioned any research on how decreasing stream flows will impact hydroelectric generation and how much. It's pretty clear that we'll have a negative impact, but I was curious to know if it could be boiled down to, you know, how many megawatt hours of generation we could potentially lose.
You were with the scientists. Have they have any early indications of how much power we would lose?
No, the UBC researchers I was with aren't looking specifically at hydro generation. They're just looking at how will the glacier melting impact stream flow, but they're not correlating that to the hydro generation. I did speak with Matthew Beadle, who's a PhD student at the University of Northern British Columbia, and he pointed to research that's been done on the eastern slopes of the Rocky Mountains, where glaciers are melting even faster. And based on research, he's done, 80 to 90% of the glacier ice on the eastern slopes of the Rockies will be gone, completely gone by the end of this century. And that equates to a decline from 1.1 to 0.1 cubic kilometers of fresh water per year. So that's the same as 1.1 to 0.1 billion pickup trucks worth of water. And again, he said correlating that to energy generation is difficult, but it's obviously quite a decline in stream flow. And so it's clear we're going to see a decline in the available hydro generation from that stream flow.
So are we all going to be plunged into a blackout because the glacier is melting?
Well, I think that we're going to have to look at other means of renewable energy generation, which is something that we're not really doing too much here of in British Columbia. We've been so dependent on hydro generation that other forms of renewable energy like wind or tidal or solar power haven't really taken off here in the province.
Well, that was a very science-heavy podcast.
Wow, every story we had included science or magic.
Or magic.
Or science and magic.
It's funny how sometimes those two things are almost inextricable.
Yeah, exactly. You just can't extract them sometimes.
So, you know what I'd like for this podcast in the future?
What?
I would really like to bring in a lot more of Tai readers.
Tai readers, Tai contributors. We're going to run the whole spectrum of different stories that people are digging up about their life here in British Columbia.
And it kind of starts with you guys, you listeners out there. If you have kind of an idea or a response to a Tai story, or you'd like a certain duo of Tai reporters, or you'd like us to put together a panel of reporters to talk about a certain issue that matters to you, we'd love to help you put that together.
So, Robin, if our readers really want
to have a structure, a panel of Thai reporters about a particular topic, is there a way they can get in touch with us to let us know to do that?
We have an email address. It's podcast@thethai.ca. And hopefully in future, we'll get a voicemail so readers can call in and leave a message and tell us what they're thinking about the Thai, where we can improve, and what they want to hear on the podcast.
Wait, you told me they'd just be calling you on your voicemail.
It's not just my voicemail.
And Robin's personal number is... You know, I'm really starting to warm up to this Chum Bucket name.
Oh, I was. Good.
It's taken me a while. It's taken me a few minutes, about 40 minutes or so, to warm up to it. But I'm really starting to do it.
It's actually really friendly if you think about it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that I'm taking stinking, rotting fish, throwing it in a bucket, and then using it as bait to catch other fish.
Yeah, I mean, that's life.
That describes exactly what we're trying to do with this podcast.
It's going
to
be gritty. It's going to be real.
Mm-hmm. Sometimes it may not smell exactly like how you want it to.
It's life.
Yeah. So the music on today's podcast, who were we listening to?
That was actually Thai reporter Jeff Dembeki. He reports on energy and oil sands issues for the Thai. That's his Vancouver-based band, Peace. I think they're actually in Ladysmith this weekend recording their new album. Ladysmith, BC, who knew? There's a fledgling music production community.
Wow.
There.
Lots of studios and places, producers.
He's promised me that he'll write about his experiences chopping wood and making music this weekend for the next weekend edition of the Thai.
Very cool.
And he never breaks a promise.
All right. And so that closes out our first episode.
Thanks a lot for listening, everybody. And we'll catch you in a few weeks on the next edition of the Thai Chum Bucket.